They have set a deadline of 48 hours. That doesn't give us much time. They will kill you, Dan. They'll kill Jane, too. She knows as much about them as I do now, maybe more. Dan, I will throw the full weight of the House of Yamagata into finding Jane and rescuing her. Dan thought, your team of bodyguards didn't do much good, pal. What can you do for her now? As if he could read Dan's thoughts, Nobo said, we know where the helicopter took her.
You do?
One of our agents managed to plant a bug on it before she was killed.
Killed, Dan said to himself. Of course, Nobo's team wouldn't let Jane out of their protection without a fight. How many casualties did they take? He asked aloud.
6 dead.
Damn. I'm sorry, Nobo.
The important fact is that we know where the helicopter landed.
Where?
At a private airport just outside Lyon.
Dan leaned back in his chair. They must have transferred her from there.
Yes. And we don't know where they've taken her.
Dan swept the room with his eyes. The bare wooden floor, the sturdy beams of the ceiling, George hulking by the fireplace, the snow piling up outside. They're holding her hostage someplace, and I'm stuck here in the ass end of Shangri-La.
I've got to get out of here, he said to Nobo. I have already dispatched a plane to the airport nearest you.
Dan pictured the bumpy grass strip that passed as an airport, down in the valley below this monastic retreat house. It'll be covered with snow, Nobo. For the first time, the trace of a smile played across Nobuhiko's face.
I am aware of the climate in the Himalayas, my friend. And the team I have sent is well acquainted with the region. 3 of them have scaled Mount Everest.
Dan grinned back at him. I should have guessed.
In the time until they reach you,
Nobo asked, his face going somber again.
What should I say to Malik?
Dan shrugged. Tell the son of a bitch that I'm on my way to Paris.
Paris? Nobo seemed startled. Is that wise?
No, said Dan. But it's necessary. Luther Clay leaned back in his creaking leather chair and wondered why the whole world seemed to conspire to make his life miserable. He had fought and struggled and scrapped for every little step up the ladder of success. Now, at his age, life should be easier, much easier. Instead, it got harder every blessed day. Clay had been appointed to head the state's Environmental Protection Office only a year earlier, the culmination of a long and dedicated career in the state bureaucracy. He had a right to expect a long and uneventful reign as the state's top environmental man, and then a peaceful and well-paid retirement. Instead, he had troubles with the mayor of New Orleans and these federal pests who insisted that the levee on Lake Pontchartrain was no longer sufficient to meet their theoretical worst-case scenario. And now he had an assistant who had just dropped a worse-than-worst-case scenario on his desk. Damn. He peered over his glasses at Regina Cartmill, sitting nervously on the front 2 inches of the chair before his desk. She was a mousy type, plain brown hair and plain vanilla skin blotched here and there with acne.
An earthquake? Asked Clay, his voice dripping with disbelief.
Bobbing her head up and down, Ms. Cartmill said,
that's what their report predicts. A Richter-scale 7 earthquake in the Gulf sometime within the next 12 months.
Clay pushed his glasses back into place. There hasn't been an earthquake in these parts within the memory of living man. I don't even think there's one on the records.
There is. I checked. 1812. The New Madrid Fault. It was one of the biggest earthquakes in history.
Clay shook his head. 1812? More than 200 years ago.
Maybe we're due for another one.
My sweet lord.
Ms. Cartmill said, but the prediction is for the quake to be out in the Gulf, hundreds of miles from here.
Well, then why the warning?
There might be disturbances in the water. You know, a tidal wave.
Tidal wave? Clay yelped. She nodded unhappily. What on earth are we supposed to do about a tidal wave?
According to the report, all we can do is evacuate all the low-lying coastal areas.
Evacuate?
That includes New Orleans, she said,
her voice so low that Clay could barely hear it. He seemed to shrivel before her eyes, sinking into the chair as if he wanted to disappear altogether.
Mr. Clay, are you all right?
Oh, I'm fine, he said.
his voice little more than a croak.
Our budget's being cut again. Our lawsuit against the companies who've been dumping raw sewage into the river has been thrown out of court. There's a madman on television telling everybody that the greenhouse is going to drown us all. My wife is hysterical because our daughter wants to marry a white boy. Now you've just told me that half the state might get flooded out. That means I've got to go to the mayor of New Orleans, who already hates the sight of me, and tell her that on some unknown day, sometime in the next 12 months, she's going to have to give the order to evacuate the city because a potential tidal wave caused by a theoretical earthquake might possibly wipe out her city. That's fine. Just perfectly fine. That's wonderful.
Despite the dogged weariness that was draining him, Dan paced the main room of the retreat house, half mad with impatience. He was perspiring beneath his heavy woolen shirt and leather vest, yet he felt chilled as if his bones were turning to ice. The fire flickered fitfully, throwing gleaming highlights on the polished wooden beams of the low ceiling. Big George banged through the door, looking like a fuzzy bear in the long-haired coat he wore. For once, no blast of wind followed him into the room.
"Storm's over," he announced, trying to sound cheerful. "Moon's up. You can even see the lights of Alphonsus and Copernicus. It's really a pretty night out there."
"Any sign of them?" Dan asked.
George shook his shaggy head.
"We might be the only 2 fucking people left on Earth for all the signs you can see out there. Not even a paw print in the snow."
He pulled off the coat and tossed it onto the chest by the door.
"Fucking beautiful, though, what with the moonlight on the new snow."
"They should have been here by now," Dan said, still pacing.
"You eating anything?"
Dan shook his head. George muttered to himself and went to the smaller room that served as a kitchen. When they had first arrived at the retreat house, they had been surprised to see a modern refrigerator, a sizable freezer, electric stove, and even a microwave oven. The lama who had guided them up the steep and narrow mountain path to the house explained with a gentle smile that although the lamas themselves were forbidden to use such luxuries, they knew that Western guests regarded them as necessities. Then he had gone outside and started the diesel generator that powered the house. Dan could not help thinking at the time that even in this remote site, in a house built by religious ascetics for peaceful contemplation, they were adding their little bit to the greenhouse effect. Later, he grumbled that the lamas had not bothered to wire the house for electrical heating, relying only on the pitiful fireplace, which also added its jot to the greenhouse. George made a meal from the dwindling supplies they had brought with them, and insisted that Dan sit at the table with him and eat.
"You've got some strenuous days ahead of you, mate," George said almost cheerfully. "Better keep up your strength, eh?"
Dan spooned whatever it was into his mouth, his mind focused on Jane. Where is she? What are they doing to her? Is she all right? Have the bastards already killed her? How can I help her, sitting here in this godforsaken shack at the ass end of nowhere with a dose of radiation sickness eating away at me?
"Where in the 7 levels of hell are they?" he shouted, slamming his spoon down on the table. George eyed him from beneath his bushy red brows.
"If you'd keep quiet for half a tick, you'd be able to hear them."
Dan's breath caught in his chest. Yes, in the stillness of the night there was a faint thrumming sound. Then he huffed and said, "It's just a damned generator." George shook his head.
"No, it's not. Listen."
It seemed as if each second stretched into eternity. But soon enough Dan realized the young Aussie was right. It was definitely the sound of a helicopter. He bolted from the table, grabbed his parka, and dashed out into the snow. The sky was bright with moonlight. The snow glittered clean and untouched except for George's own tracks around the cabin. And up in that sky, clattering and thundering like a giant mechanical insect, Dan saw the black silhouette of a helicopter approaching.
"Hey, you're right, Georgie. It's a beautiful night. A gorgeous night."
He laughed and pounded the big man's back.
37.
"You don't look so well," said Vasily Malik.
"Never mind that," Dan snapped.
"We have work to do, and less than 24 hours to do it." They sat facing each other on the fantail of a luxury yacht under the warm Mediterranean sun, beneath the shade